You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is my dear colleague, Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
That's me. I'm doing good.
I'm glad to hear it. I am your other co-host, Mark Bigney, and we're going to be talking about board games this week. But first, an editorial correction. We take our editorial corrections very seriously, even when the topic is very foolish. On a couple of different episodes, I have mischaracterized what a push present is. I was misinformed, and the context was confusing, and I reached the wrong conclusion. It turns out that a push present is just a gift you give to someone who has just given birth. This is what I would call a gross term, and that having been said, I would like to retract all the unkind things I said about push presents. By all means, gift things to people who have just given birth.
I've never heard of that.
But it's a term.
Okay.
It is a widely used term. I heard it for the first time, and I must have reached the wrong conclusion about what it was. I had thought that a push present was a present you give to somebody to push them to do something, which is a vile and odious tactic, one that I have done myself in my earlier, more vulnerable board gaming days when I didn't have enough people to play games with. It's a thing. Instead, in this case, it was a push present of some board games to someone who's just given birth, which is a strange choice because, generally speaking, they're not known for having lots of time, energy, and mental wherewithal for such things. But whatever. It was well-intentioned, but I thought that it wasn't well-intentioned. I would like to apologize to anyone who was given push presents, who's received push presents. We were in error, and I sincerely regret the error. Well, we're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter, and then we're going to go on to our feature game, which is Seven Empires by Matt Gertz. So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, I got Galactic Cruise back to the table. This is designed by T.K. King, Dennis Northcott, and Colton Thompson. And it was like a 100% better experience.
Oh, really?
The second time you play.
Because the first time we enjoyed it.
Yes.
But we had some structural misgivings, potentially.
Yeah. This was much, much more enjoyable.
Oh, that's very promising.
Everything made but sense. We played with like the standard game where it just changed, you know, changed the goals up, changed the technologies up.
Yep.
Changed all the action spots, how they, you know, where they were on the table. And just so, because you sort of knew what the flow was going to be already, so you weren't, you know, trying to figure things out on the way. You just knew what needed to be done.
Because Galactic Cruise is a relatively heavy Euro game. It's kind of in a Lacerda mold-ish. But we don't tend to very much like Vital Lacerda games for a variety of reasons. Thematic disconnect, mechanical overcomplexity, sometimes obtuse scoring, various problems that we have with them. But Galactic Cruise, it obviously being a game about running space cruises, and has a very simple action selection mechanism. Not a whole lot of combo-tastic combos. But nonetheless, just some pretty crunchy decision-making and resource management. And what new horizons opened for you on this new play?
I didn't do well, but I still had fun playing. I got a bunch of gears out, so, you know, I could, you know, do actions anywhere I wanted pretty well. And got some endgame scoring with that as well. Had an interesting card. Remember there was that one sort of upgrade you get where you could make your ship extra big?
Yes.
I found a card that just let you do that when you did a build action. You could just add an extra module to your 3-stage ship.
Oh, really?
So I had this giant ship.
That's wild.
So that's what you're doing in Galactic Cruise. You're building a space cruise ship.
There were several.
And I went with, like, mine was zero-G themed. I had like the spacewalk and the zero-G arcade and robot battle. It was great. I had the greatest cruise ship, so it didn't matter.
Sorry,
if
what,
I
robot
lost.
Fights?
Yes.
We had robot fights.
I had robot fights.
What? Why do people keep having properties with robot fights and they don't immediately call me? This is unfortunate.
There you go.
Stealth robot fights are completely unacceptable. You have to tell me about these things. It's like when some of my favorite bands release a new album and don't tell me. This is an outrage.
So yeah, you can have robot fights upon your galactic cruise. Someone else had it. Actually, I shouldn't say mine was the greatest ship. There was also the ship across the table, which was board game, burgers, and something else. I thought that was equally amazing.
I don't know. Conceptually, that's great, but you need some really sci-fi technology because a burger is not a board game friendly food.
True, but they got upset when I was just sort of sitting in the shipyard on a milk crate waiting. And it was just sort of like, you know, what are you doing here? It's like, I know what's going on. I'll just be here waiting for when it's completed.
Sure.
It was great. Galactic Cruise. Looking forward to more games.
Yeah, that's very promising. I would very much like to play it again. We were very curious. It was promising on first play. Did you try any of the expansions or you just did the full game?
No, just full game. Yeah. Well, we played with the cards that come in the expansion. They were just added in because they just add more variety.
Oh, okay.
And every so often one would come up that didn't apply because there was additional sort of...
It would refer to a module that wasn't in play.
And so we just skip that and pull again. But yeah.
Is that an approved way to play? Is that a recommended way to play? Or is that just something you did?
That's just something we did.
Cool.
And for those that care, this was the game we streamed this week. So if you wanted to check it out, you can go to our live tab on YouTube and watch our play of Galactic Cruise by Kingston Key Games.
I have to say, I am a little bit... This is more of a long-term concern rather than a short-term concern. I'm a little bit concerned about those cards because they do seem to be that if you have the right one at the right time, it can be very consequential. And then there are a lot of them that don't seem to be particularly interesting.
True, but we have to... I don't think in either play were the cards used for the resources that were on them as well. Because you have to remember each one has a resource symbol, and so if you have cards that you don't like...
That's true.
Either A, you can use them as resources, or B, there's a very big action that lets you refill a vat that gets you lots of money that you also have to discard a card for as well.
Right.
Yeah.
I get to play Cerebria the Inside World on the topic of slightly heavier Euro games, of which we are very fond. Cerebria is definitely one of my favorites. It is by Mind Clash Games. It was their second published design, and it remains quite outside most releases that you encounter in this weight. It is a very dynamic area majority game that represents kind of sort of the development of consciousness of a human person, and you play various emotions to influence their state, and it is bliss versus gloom, and you're effectively trying to make the individual relentlessly happy or relentlessly gloomy. They'll almost invariably end up with an admixture of both, which I would probably assert off the top of my head being a relatively healthy way to turn out. But
yeah, and the artist has rendered these creatures to represent all of these emotions.
Yeah, every emotion is personified.
And that adds so much to the game. Like, can you imagine if it was just sort of like a, you know what I mean? If it was a card set, like if they weren't creatures and they didn't have this like elaborate color scheme and look so great, I think it would be a different type of game.
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, it definitely adds to the experience, but the thing is the game is so heavy and so tactical that I'm constantly just concerned about how to eke out a slight advantage over my scarce turn with the scarce resources I have. When the cards are in my hand, you know, I look at them and say, oh, well, that's cute. I then look up what the special power is because every card has a special power and every card has an upgraded version with a special power and every player character has a special power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's even on the symmetrical sides. One thing I keep forgetting about because I haven't been able to play Cerebria multiple times with the same group for quite some time. And on the backside of every character, not only do they have an asymmetric special power, but all their actions become asymmetric now too, because every action has an upgrade tree. When they're symmetrical, it's fine, and you already end up with a huge degree of asymmetry because of what people choose to upgrade and when. But when all the actions are radically different, oh, you don't have access to that upgrade anymore. Now you have this other weird thing, and the base version is also weird, and it takes forever for people to internalize that if they don't already know the game. Once people insisted, I will never, ever do that with new players ever again with Cerebria. But normally, after a 45-minute-plus rules explanation of Cerebria, people know what they're getting into, and they don't want more. They're ready with, quote-unquote, just Cerebria. But it is absolutely worth it. The scoring is tight and focused. The competition is intense. It is super tactical with some strategic horizons mixed in. This game in particular saw the interplay between, broadly speaking, the two different kinds of scoring. There are these moments during the game called revelations, where you have competitive scoring, where you want to beat the other team in various things. But then there is the possibility of scoring incremental points over the course of your turn as well for doing various things. If you do that the first time during your turn, you get 1 point. But every subsequent instance of that thing happening, or any other condition, gives you 2 more points. So there's a huge difference between triggering it once and triggering it twice or 3 times. And I was playing with a spirit called Love, which is very good at triggering those kinds of scoring instances during the game. And so although the center spire, which is the consequence of scoring revelations, it's this lovely three-dimensional representation of how well each team is doing, because as you score, you stack large or small pieces onto the central tower. That was relatively equal between the two teams, but our team had managed to do those during the turn interstitial scoring moments much more, largely by virtue of the fact that I was more experienced with the game. I'm not going to claim that I outplayed anybody. I don't think I'm very good at Cerebria. I find myself usually by turn three thinking, the longer this game goes, the worse I'm going to do, because I'm too short-sighted to really take advantage of the long-term horizons. I need to end this quick. Which, frankly, is often how I view lots of games. Generally speaking, whenever I do well in a game, it's because I did well in the early turns and then watch my lead dwindle.
That's right. These people are building engines. It's time to end this quickly.
Exactly. I've taken all the low-hanging fruit. All these other people have built this infrastructure, which is really well done, and it's starting to hum. I better get out of here while I can. That's largely the vibe. And sure enough, that was true in Cerebria. On the topic of vibes, there's a whole lot of technical terms. Some of them really matter. It's awkward. The final product hangs together beautifully, which is a bit of a triumph. It's just there's a lot there. And so it's difficult to get to the table. It's a 4-player-only game with new players. Once you've got experience with the game, you can start playing around with different player counts, maybe adding the expansion, which brings the game up to a possible of 6. Downtime at that point would get kind of ridiculous. One of the players at the table did complain about downtime. And sure enough, the game isn't very long, but turns can tend to be pretty involved because you have 3 actions and an absorb action. And trying to plot that out, again, to eke out the marginal advantage, and sometimes you have to start again and recalculate from scratch. But the thing is, because it's a team-based game, one of the other players at the table is effectively taking turns for you. And so there's a certain amount of collaborative team element that I think helps with the downtime considerably. Because there's not going to be quarterbacking, strictly speaking, and indeed, it is difficult to internalize another player's play state simply by virtue of the volume of things going on, as well as their hidden hand of cards. But nonetheless, if you view the other 3 turns as irrelevant to your play state, yeah, the downtime is going to be bad, and then when it's your turn to start, you have to recalculate everything from scratch. Anyway, I always find Cerebria engaging, but I can't say that that was the experience of everyone at the table. Everyone liked the game, and they're keen to get more experience with it so they can internalize some of the important systems. I think Cerebria is marvelous. I think it's under-discussed. I think it's often slept on, even in the context of the catalog of Mind Clash games. You know, we talk a lot about Anachrony, we hear a lot about Dracarion, obviously we hear a lot about more recent releases, but Cerebria is marvelous and utterly unlike anything else in my collection. I highly recommend it if you're into heavier Euros. That's Cerebria the Inside World, published in 2018, designed by a small army consisting of Richard Amon, Victor Peter, Istan Poxy, Frigius Schorbel, Nick Shaw, and David Zirkze.
We got a review copy of Phantom Division. This is designed by Pete Ruth and Mark Thomas.
So this is a production sample, not a prototype, but not a finished version either. It is a production sample with some prototype elements tossed in there.
This is published by Phantom Horizon. And what it is a sort of skirmishy type dexterity game that's cooperative. So you're playing on a team against sort of
Alien apes
that, you know, move around automatically. And so you infiltrate, you're given missions. And I really love the objective system. So what you do is you roll some primary missions until you have 3 slots full. And then you fill the rest of the slots with secondary missions.
So the way that it works is there's this pool of objective tokens that are put in specific places, but they're randomized as to which one is there. So you get line of sight to an objective token, you flip it over, oh, it's F, that corresponds to this secondary objective, you pull the secondary objective and see what it does. A primary objective might occupy one slot or more slots, depending on what it is. For example, we had one objective that related to two mercury bombs, and so that occupied two slots, so both objectives A and B were those aforementioned bombs. It's a really slick system. It's well done.
Yeah, so you know what your main objectives are. You just don't know where they are. Secondary objectives, you don't know what they are, but and all you know is that, you know, the throughout the map, there's those tokens. So as soon as they flip up, it could be a bomb, it could be a boss, it could be all sorts of different things. And so not only are you flicking to shoot the enemies, there's also all of these very interesting mini games. So you want to unlock a door, you flip a code card, you put tokens, you take out your mini board that has a keypad sort of on it, and you put tokens on the numbers that the code is, and then you have X number of flicks in order to knock those off. And there's also timed ones, and if you go down, there's like a life support one that you need to balance a marble and push discs around.
Those new marble ones are brutal.
Yeah, that's another reason why I very much enjoy it. Because I'm not saying I'm the greatest at dexterity games, but a lot of times, you know, there's easy elements in some dexterity games. This, not so much.
Oh, yeah, super challenging.
Like, we had the mercury bomb was, as you said, brutal.
Utterly brutal.
So these boards are like a rectangle. Let's say that there are 4 by 8. And so for the mercury bomb, on one side, there is 4 holes in a cross where you're going to put the marble in the middle. And you have to hang on to it from the other end. And then what you have to do is make sure you're only holding it by one hand now while balancing the marble, not letting it go down the holes or off the card or past the halfway mark. And then you have to take cubes and put them in certain spots on the other half.
Yeah. We are, so as longtime listeners know, this is a sequel to the only game that matters, SEAL Team Flicks, which was also a cooperative squad-based skirmishy dexterity game. And Phantom Division really leans in to the strengths of the minigame aspect of SEAL Team Flicks. It's a marvelous opportunity to just bust out something else, have a cool, gimmicky, but I don't mean that in a bad way, little set piece moment. And Walker is indeed right. This, all the new marble stuff, I found the revive minigame that you play when an agent is downed to be very well calibrated, because it asks you to do a very difficult thing to come back with more than just one hit point when you come back on your feet. And I was able to get one more hit point out of the process of this minigame, and I counted myself lucky, because them marble games are hard. The mercury bomb ones, woof. We failed both of those hard. We did practice runs that went nowhere. I tried a bunch, Walker tried a bunch. We were not able to get anywhere close to finishing. It is super difficult, but I look forward to really doubling down on some of these fun new side toys.
Yeah, and so the way they've done the map is completely different. It's a pre-printed neoprene mat that you are going to build the walls every time, but you can build them differently. So the layout could be different, but the sort of printed amounts will be the same. And it's the same sort of patrol. Is it exactly similar to
It is very similar. There are only minor differences to how the broad parameters under which the enemies move. Overall, running the AI has been simplified and certainly presented better. The first SEAL Team Flicks had a number of very unfortunate phrasing issues that led people to reach very common misconceptions. Many of those have been ironed out. Maybe some new ones have been introduced. More on that later. But overall, the movement of the enemies has been simplified, and there are very minor differences.
And it's super smooth. So it's nice and easy. You're not worried about what they're doing. You get to game it out on top of that.
Well, you are worried about what they're doing.
But yes.
But I mean, like, it's not super confusing about how they're going to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
We had, in terms of the overall stealth, managing stealth is very difficult. And I believe that SEAL Team Flicks, prior to the publication of Phantom Division, which is yet to happen, obviously, did stealth better than any other game that I'd encountered, because there was this ebb and flow of when you were going to be going loud, as it were, which is basically a colloquial term for shooting people in the face, and being more quiet, waiting for things to die down, waiting for the spawns to die down, sneaking from room to room before you make your next move. In the context of Phantom Division, I felt that they've really done the old noise system of SEAL Team Flex I thought was really good. I think the new threat system of Phantom Division, if anything, is even better, because in the one mission that we played, we got into a bit of a tough spot. We kind of decided to plant our feet in a bad place. And we realized that, so we're like, okay, we're going to have to take risks. We're going to have to take a couple shots in the process, but we need to get out of here. And then we laid low for a few rounds, and then the heat was off, and then we were able to make a push for the final objectives. I thought we were toast midway through, but we were able to take a step back and readjust, and I was very impressed. Yeah. Not with us, with the game.
With the game. It has a loot system that's interesting. You get new and different guns along the way, and you add them to your little foot locker so you can use them on new missions. So it's going to have like a campaign system where you can spend experience points and get stuff. That's yet to be seen if that shakes out, but it seems interesting.
Well, it's already, it's got a relatively simple campaign structure in that you get a certain number of experience points, possibly zero, if Walker keeps having mercury bombs.
Not for disarming mercury bombs yet.
And then you just use those experience points as a currency to buy new stuff like augments. And even after the first mission, I saw that there were some relatively inexpensive augments that are just really, really good. Like a 2 experience point augment that gives you 1 extra movement point every time you move, which is great because being able to move 5 as opposed to being able to move 4 is pretty awesome. So I will say that I've got 2 misgivings so far about Phantom Division. And to a certain extent, this is consonant with some of the issues that I had with SEAL Team Flex. Much as I love it, it's not perfect. The game took much longer than I would have liked, and that was largely driven by, I don't know how much of that is the game itself, and I don't know how much of it is driven by the second big issue, which I will only mention briefly. It's not worth making a whole capital case out of it yet. The rulebook is in a very rough shape, and we've been compiling problems and issues that we have. There were a number of issues where, like, this isn't mentioned in the rulebook, so let's play it the same way that it worked in SEAL Team Flicks. There are other issues where it's like, well, this is new. We don't know how to do it analogously to SEAL Team Flicks. But that is one of the good things about being involved in a quasi-playtest, which is effectively what we're doing here, kind of, sort of. So later on this week, I'm going to be sending a long email to the publishers of Phantom Division saying, these are the things that we think you need to address. And if those are addressed, I hope the playtime can go down and the play experience can be smoother. Because as it was a little clunky and took too long for my taste. I don't know what balance of that is rules problems versus just the mission structure being a little bit longer than I think it ought to be. That having been said, I think that Phantom Division does a very, very good job of building on the strengths of SEAL Team Flex and addressing some of the weaknesses. So I'm very optimistic.
Yeah, and the setup is not nothing, but for...
I'm also curious about the setup. Walker did the kindness of setting the game up for me. I'd want to see how long that took, because Teardown took a while.
True, but I think for what you're getting, it's worth it. Like, do you want just the same static map over and over again?
I love those maps.
It is, but for the amount of room they take up and and the initial...
Oh, I understand why they changed it. Yeah, but...
And so I think it's worth what you're getting, is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, I'll probably be in a better position to evaluate... The map looks great.
Yes.
And the new components look great. We've got screen-printed discs and painted blocks. Instead of just generic blocks, we've got different kinds of blocks, and they've got interesting graphical detail on them. And the plastic walls are awesome, and the plastic doors are cool. And this, it's all great. But Teardown was a bear. I'm curious to see how long setup takes. And I did... Setting up the maps for the first time in SEAL Team Flex took forever, but I did quite like them. They were very cool and very different and offered different tactical challenges in each, and I'm curious to see how different maps evolve in the case of Phantom Division.
And I put a video up for people that are interested. I made a little turntable board for Phantom Division and or Catacombs. If you're interested in that kind of thing, take a look at our live channel.
Highly recommend the Lazy Susan board. It's great. Walker should launch a Kickstarter for this for board gaming in due time, and then we can retire on our millions. I will just take 10%.
And that's Phantom Division.
That's Phantom Division. Definitely more to follow, because we are curious to see these issues and to see other missions. And
oh, yes. So the Kickstarter ended this week, but I'm sure that there might be a late pledge coming soon. Keep your eye open.
There are aspirations of retail. The state is in flux. We don't know what's going on, but there's been a lot been discussed. Played another game of Space Gits. Space Gits is another kind of tactical dexterity hybrid, but this is a tabletop miniatures game involving drunken orcs designed by Mike Hutchison, he of Gaslands fame. So one of my favorite tabletop miniatures designers working today. This was successfully kickstarted not too long ago. We're in a strange interstitial period, and I don't quite understand the logic behind this. So before the Kickstarter started, anybody who was a patron of Mike Hutchison could get access to, well, Planet Smasher Games, his game company, could get access to the alpha version of the rules. Or you could give him a couple bucks on itch.io and get access to the alpha version. Then there was the Kickstarter campaign. It launched. And then during the Kickstarter campaign, everyone had access to the latest version of the rules. And the rules went into beta at that time, more than doubling in length, involving vehicle rules and a whole bunch of other stuff, and a lot of new army building options and some solid improvements to the system. And then the Kickstarter campaign stopped, and now there's no versions of the file available anywhere. Until such time as he's come up with the final version, in which case those who've pledged will get their copies, and those who haven't pledged will have the availability to buy it in other ways. So I discovered to my horror that I had not saved a beta version of the rules, which is the version that Walker and I had played previously a few weeks ago. I only had access to the alpha version. So when I had opportunity to play again, this time with the Hahnwerker, I sort of basically in my head kitbashed together elements from the beta that I liked with the version of the alpha that I was able to find nestled as an attachment in some email that I'd sent months ago. It's a whole thing. Anyway, so I played a version of Space Kits. The core of Space Kits, though, is very simple and very awesome. You activate whatever orc you want. They do two actions, and then they take a swig. And whenever you take a swig or whenever you take damage, you're adding more dice to your tower of dice next to your orc. There's a picture that I put up on social media of one of Hahnwerker's units, which had been shot many times and had a lot of damage. And so it's this massive tower. Why is a big tower bad? Isn't big good? No, not in this case. Because whenever you move the orc, the tower has to be in contact with the orc at all times. And if the tower falls over for any reason, so does the orc. And falling over is more or less being dead. You can get back, but it's difficult because movement is wild and chaotic. Did I mention that the orcs are drunk? They're a little drunk. Similarly, everything with respect to moving and shooting is about rolling dice, and they will move in the direction towards the die wherever it hits the table, and they will shoot in the direction of wherever the die hits. So, yeah, you're going to be shooting your friends, you're going to be blowing up barrels accidentally, you're going to be wandering in strange directions because the die bounce in an odd way, and it's glorious. Honestly, Space Kits is probably the best tabletop miniatures game I've played since Horizon War Zero Dark. It is amazing. It is just the right level of simple for years, Walker. I don't know if you've ever encountered this lie. You see that tabletop miniatures rule sets say, oh, you can play this game in an hour.
No.
Always a lie. Tabletop miniatures games, I love them, but there's a certain amount of faffing about and ambiguity, and the rules tend to be a little thorny in all the traditional areas. Space Kits is the first tabletop miniatures game I've ever played that is super easy to pick up and play, and yet is satisfying both in terms of decisions and in terms of execution. It is a triumph, and I absolutely adore Space Kits. I love it, love it, love it. More tabletop miniatures, dexterity games, hybrids, please. Because if you want to include Phantom Division and SEAL Team Flex, you kind of could. That's a bit of a reach. But Flick Fleet is glorious. Space Kits is glorious. These are fabulous experiences, and I cannot recommend Space Kits highly enough. You can't get the rules at the moment, but I'll let you know when you can, and I look forward to the final version.
And what do you think the Hahnwerker thought?
The Hahnwerker enjoyed it. I had misinterpreted his initial reaction to hearing the pitch as him thinking he was above such things. I was wrong. It was another push-present type mistake on my part. I do have a certain sense of internalized inferiority about Adoration of Dexterity games because so many people dismiss it as mere toy play. Of course it's toy play, but it's not mere toy play. So he seemed to enjoy it, probably not as much as I do, but I don't know that anyone has my level of affection for Space Kits when not inebriated. And I'm looking forward even to trying the vehicle rules. Vehicle rules are tough. It's tough to do vehicles in miniatures gaming, especially in a skirmish level, but I'm curious to see what happens. I mean, Mike Hutchison has serious design chops, and he thinks outside the box in the best possible ways. Space Kits is marvelous. Can't wait for the finished version.
So I return to Earthborn Rangers. That's two games in 2 weeks, Mark.
That's twice as many.
Maybe this campaign might have legs. We'll see. This is designed by Andrew Fletcher, Brooks Fudgar-Levitt, Andrew Navarro, Adam Sadler, and Brady Sadler, and published by Earthborn Games. And it was much of the same, be that good or bad. I'm beginning to wonder if I'm enjoying it because it's a cooperative game with a friend,
mm-hmm.
like a cooperative campaign-y adventure game. Because I really want more of a feel when I play the cards that the cards mean something other than successes. It's always about successes.
Just generating symbols.
And I don't want much. I just want this card that it says it's doing something. I want it to feel like I'm doing that thing, other than just saying, well, I wanted, you know, anyway.
You feel that in this campaign adventure thing, which is narrative heavy, you get to the narrative and then the narrative stops and then suddenly you're just generating symbols completely divorced from anything else.
Exactly.
Yeah, I can see that being pretty jarring.
I want a lightning bolt to feel like I'm casting a lightning bolt. No, I'm just putting tokens on this card because it needs 8 tokens on it so we can advance the storyline.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I've bounced off of similar card games. Like I tried the Arkham Horror card game several times, and at the end of the day, it's like just generate tokens on this card to move to the next step. Okay, like we've been doing this same fundamental thing, just piling success tokens on cards for a long time, and it doesn't. It's difficult to make that feel thematically evocative, and when the rest of the campaign structure is meant to be telling a story and then the actual gameplay falls flat in that sense, it's tough.
We did get some reward cards that might have some promise to do that kind of thing, but we will see. So another full session. Huey's eager to do more. I'm happy to oblige. We'll get some more games in of Earthborn Rangers, and I will get back to you.
All right. Played into the game of, okay, I've had a little bit of a question about how to pronounce this. So I've been saying Dropolter, but I think it should be Dropolter, like Dropolter, Dropolter, I think. Anyway, the Oinky Dexterity game. It's spelled Dropolter, 2 different words, but it's like a play on drop and poltergeist. So I think it's Dropolter, Dropolter.
Is it actually English? I thought it was German.
It is both English and German.
Okay, but I have to see what the German translation is then.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. Anyway, so I'm probably going to say it a different way every time now that I'm just confused.
Because if you're not actually dropping the poltergeist.
No, but there are poltergeists and you're dropping things. Like, yeah. I think you're overthinking that part. Anyway, Dropolter is designed by Paul Schultz, published by Oink Games in 2023. It is a marvelous real-time dexterity game. It's been a dexterity-heavy week for me, and I would have it no other way. You have these 5 items, which are nominally meant as charms to scare away ghosts. Walker's got a great bit about how everyone obviously keeps their holy wafers in the night bedstand, obviously. Exactly. I don't know what I do with my holy wafers. I've never had any. Actually, that's not true. I used to be Roman Catholic. So, you have these 5 items in your hand, and you're obliged to drop a certain subsection of them in order to score a point, which is represented by a bell. Where does the bell go? Well, the bell goes in your hand. What happens if you drop the bell? The bell's gone. So the number of times, the sheer number of bells that go through my score pile in and out over the course of the game tend to be very, very high. I tend to get overeager and a little bit happy with the dropping of the bells. And there's another very serious occupational hazard when playing with Dropolter, which is the sweat. It doesn't have to be hot. It's just you're clutching these things very, very hard. And eventually you get an extra sense of friction by virtue of the perspiration. And in this case, something else happened, Walker, which is the glitter on the shells started bleeding off onto everyone's hands.
Really?
Yeah. Not a whole lot. Like, when I say that glitter got places it doesn't belong, people who are familiar with glitter immediately start coming up with nightmare situations where the glitter's in your eye or the glitter's all over the place, the glitter can't get out of your clothes,
Mark,
the glitter's stuck
in the
rug. Let
me tell you, you can get in a lot of trouble when glitter gets where it's not supposed to be.
I know. Look, you say that like it's a joke. I understand where you're going, but it's a serious thing. It was a mild glitter inconvenience. On a scale of glitter incidences, I would definitely put it like at a 2 out of 10. So it's not a huge deal, but nonetheless, we all had glittery hands at the end of this. It might have just been the copy of Dropolter that we were playing with. But Oink games tend to be pretty goofy, and I mean that largely as a term of endearment. But I do think that Dropolter does a great job of leveraging a novel dexterity experience and some very, very cute custom components in those teeny, teeny, tiny, adorable little boxes. So for me, when it comes to Oink Games, I know a lot of people like Fake Artist Goes to New York. But for me, the very pinnacle of Oink Games output has been Scout and Dropolter. So if you have the opportunity, if you like novel dexterity games, Dropolter is an excellent, excellent title. I highly recommend it.
Lastly, from me, I got to show Mark Shackleton Base, A Journey to the Moon. This is published by Pandasaurus Games and designed by Fabio Lupiano and Nestore Maggioni. And once again, we played Baby's First Crater, which I think is the best way to play the first few games of Shacklin base because there's a lot going on.
Yeah, so it's one of those modular setups, not entirely unlike SETI and a number of other recent Euros, where you've got the core elements and then there are the ancillary elements which you can mix up and match. So in SETI, it's aliens. In Shackleton base, it's which three corporations are in play. The corporations are rated in complexity from 1 to 4. There are 4 level 1s, 2 level 2s, and a level 3 and a level 4. And in Baby's first Shackleton base, you play with all level 1s. When you first played the game, you played it with Warm Boy, who decided to punk you all by immediately subjecting you to 2 level 2s and a level 3, which is redonkulous because even the level 1s, they're not particularly complicated, but they each have their own subsystems and are grafted on top of a relatively meaty Euro management game anyway. And so I can completely understand why your brain started leaking outside your ear.
Yeah, when the first time you're just trying to wrestle with what's going on and now you have all these sideboards that have their own little mini games going on, it's a lot. So what you're doing in Shacklin Base is that you're taking these workers and you're taking actions, and then the workers sometimes turn into astronauts, which come back to your board, and they give you scoring opportunities and discounts. So you're trying to improve your board. You're trying to have area majority in a bunch of different ways in the crater with buildings because you want people to pay you money. You also want to win the astronauts that are in each row and column. Lots going on. You're picking up tourists. You're taking them on adventures.
I hate those tourists so much.
You are.
They're such obnoxious jerks. They show up like they invented space.
It's true. Speaking of inventions, you're making inventions. You're doing experiments. You also have a delivery company where you're taking out different stuff to different areas. Lots going on. I very much enjoy Shackleton Base.
Shackleton Base is very good. I would compare it to Autobahn for 2 reasons. Reason the first, same design team. Reason the second, it's very much in the same kind of style of medium-heavy Euro that I very much like. However, I think that at the end of the day, I'm going to end up preferring Autobahn for a couple of reasons. One of them is the scoring in Autobahn is just so marvelously focused. I really, really appreciate that. Shackleton Base isn't quite point salad, but there's a little bit of that going on. There's a fair amount of different things. The other element is that the shared geography of Autobahn is much more salient than the shared geography that goes on in Shackleton Base. You talked about how there's kind of sort of an area majority element going on the board. I wish that played a more prominent aspect, if it was more consequential, because if you don't have area majority for the relevant purposes on the board, what that means is you might lose out on a couple bucks when you do a certain kind of action. Hardly a huge deal. Failing that, you could just jump in relatively inexpensively if you wanted to, if that couple bucks was a huge burden, and then you wouldn't have to pay it anymore. You don't even need majority in many cases. You just need to be there. So unlike the sometimes cutthroat but nonetheless demanding geography of the Autobahn, it's like, oh, they got to that road section, they got to that gas station, they got to that route connection, whatever. And or playing off of each other's presences, like, oh, I need to compete for the board, etc. Shackleton Base felt far more like a multiplayer solitaire endeavor, which is okay. It's fine. It's part and parcel of a lot of Euro design elements. It wasn't egregious. There was a certain amount of competition over resources, and that part was fine. I did really like, though, the added variety of the corporations. They felt surprisingly well integrated into the core gameplay experience. Essentially, what happens is the presence of the different corporations populates the board with different kinds of tokens. There are ways to activate those tokens, and they give you a corporation-specific resource. And then there are a variety of different venues, not a whole lot, but, you know, a couple ways to get corporation actions, which is a catch-all term, which means do something with a board. So just to take one example, these aren't particularly earth-shattering innovations in terms of gameplay. So there was one corporation that would give you a unique type of resource, and then for corporation action, you could sell various resources in various combinations for some set of other goods. And each of these sales could be done once per round. Okay, fine. There was another corporation where you would just generate these new resources, and then you would recipe fulfill for these tokens. Yeah, fine. Relatively straightforward. I would, however, observe that in the case of that particular corporation, that last one, I was a little unsatisfied about how the power scaled up. So Shackle to the Base proceeds over three rounds. And in the case of that latter corporation that I mentioned, the tiles that you could purchase with this recipe fulfillment in rounds one and two were okay-ish. And then I was getting into round three. I don't know why I'd done this, largely by accident, or because it just seemed like an okay thing to do at the time. I had a large quantity, and a reasonably healthy supply of these corporation-specific resources. And being the noble individual to suffer very loudly as I am, I was complaining about how Walker and Huey had basically focused on the other two corporations, that this third corporation was kind of useless. And then the third round came along, and I saw what the round three tiles got you. And I'm like, oh, great. And proceeded to romp all over things just by virtue of how incredibly powerful these round three tiles were. I'm not saying that it's unbalanced. What I'm saying is that it's a little out of proportion to itself. And so that was a little bit of a misgiving. That having been said, I'm very keen to see the other Shackleton-based corporations. I am a big fan of this kind of semi-modular Euro style, whether it's in later games like Ethnos, where you're playing with a different subset of racial cards every game, or whether it's like SETI or Shackleton Base. I will say that compared to SETI, Shackleton Base's corporations are more consequential than the different aliens, and they feel more different than the different aliens do in SETI. That was one of my minor disappointments in SETI. So I'm very excited to see more. I think this is a great design team. We've liked Fabio Lopiano's designs for a while, and his co-work with Nestore Mangione is great. And so I was very pleasantly surprised by Shackleton Base, and I even had relatively high expectations, so I'm looking forward to trying some more.
I really like how there's a set of cards for recuperation as well.
Yeah.
And I like how different they are for that, because the one tourist one, you needed to have those cards in order for that sort of mechanism to work. You need somewhere to put the tourists, where the other ones lean more in just helping you do what those corporations did.
Yeah, the non-tourist corporate, we played with three corporations again. The non-tourist corporations were relatively straightforward. The corporations gave you a new kind of resource, and you used that resource to buy stuff from the corporations effectively, some combination of points and other resources. The tourist thing seemed really cool. I just didn't explore it much. And so I'm very curious to try a little bit of the more complex corporations and see how much they alter the feel of the game. That was Shackleton Base, A Journey to the Moon. Finally for me, Tonks!
Tonks!
The other game I played with the Handwerker was Tonks! Tonks is a tabletop miniatures war game of, as you might imagine, Tonks. Tonks are super deformed tanks.
And you tonk your tonk.
You know, that is exactly how I started talking halfway through the game. I was like, okay, I'm going to tonk the tonk, and over here, I'm going to tonk and see what happens, roll the die, tonk! It was literally like the way the Smurfs talk. I started using tonk for everything. The best part of Tonks were the tonks. And I'm being serious here. I'm not using tonk for a generic term. The Handwerker had these chibi, super deformed tonks with movable turrets. It was great. Now, in the game of Tonks, you can move the turrets. Every time you activate a tonk, you get three actions. You can move, you can fire, you can reload, you can move the turret. When I read the rules a while ago, I thought, I think this is just going to be a game of pitching a D6, seeing who hits. That's more or less how the game shook out. There was a tiny bit of maneuver-ish, kind of. But one of the potentially interesting aspects, namely having your facing be different from your fire arc, which is a game, which is a notion exploited by many a tabletop miniatures game, even other games as venerable as Battletech, didn't really shake out very well because in Tonks, kind of evocative of actual tank warfare from what I'm led to believe, it is most difficult to hit a tank head-on. It's easier to hit them from the flank, and it is easiest to hit them from the rear. So you never, ever want to present your flank or your rear to the enemy. So if you're moving your turret, you're literally firing at something at your flank or your rear. That's not what you want. You don't want enemies to be in those places. So instead of taking an action to move your turret, why don't you spend an action to move and turn? And that's mostly what we did. So at the end of the day, it was also much longer than it should have been, because to hit head-on, you need to roll a 6 on a d6. In order to hit from the side, you need a 5 or a 6, and from the rear, you get a 4, 5, or 6. So many misses. So even though a turn is very quick, you say, I'm tonking my tonk, I tonk the tonk, oh, I rolled a 3, reloading, tonking again, oh, rolled a 4, that's a miss, your turn. Just lots and lots of missing.
Just turn into a dexterity game. Flick a disc, if you hit the tank, boom, dead. All right, moving on.
Walker has fixed tonks. Walker has issued the improvement we need to Tonks. Anyway, I really liked the pieces. The pieces were adorable. The conceit of the game is good. I like the fact that it's been to be fast playing for lots of players, but it just did nothing for me mechanically at all. Tonks, this is by Apocrypha Now, self-published on the web, 2023.
Those are the games we played this week. Now a quick break to pay some bills.
This episode is brought to you by ExpressVPN. I know people who spend over $100 on streaming services every month, but with ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and get a massive amount of content. Netflix hides stuff from you based on your location, but ExpressVPN can let you access content region-locked in over 100 different countries. For example, The Shawshank Redemption is available in neither the US nor Canada, but with ExpressVPN, you can say bonjour or konnichiwa to the servers that carry it. My American friends can pretend to be Canadian and enjoy Downton Abbey, which they normally can't on account of some revolution or something. I've tried other VPNs, and ExpressVPN is my favorite. It's incredibly easy to use, lightweight, super fast, and it works on all my devices. I have way too many. With just the click of a button, I can swap back and forth to or from any region's content. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 4 months of ExpressVPN for free.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And we're back with the news. Freedom Freeze is putting out some new games. Quite a few, in fact. One is going to be called Formidable Farm.
It's good to know. Look, Freedom Freeze, there are some reliable things in life. Death, taxes, and Freedom Freeze using Fs at the center. I love it.
And then some card games. We have Fearless and Five Families. And I feel as though Freedom Freeze, all of his games are good.
I don't know about that.
I don't think they're all great, but I've yet to play one that I didn't think was good.
Fair enough. That's probably fair. He's definitely one of the most venerable board game designers that is still constantly trying new things, right?
Yes.
And I'm certainly not going to assert that his oeuvre is as wide-ranging as, say, Vlada Kavadil in his prime, but he's definitely branching further afield than a lot of people at this stage in their career.
So more about that later. I'm sure I'll pick them all up.
All of them.
All of them.
Each and every one.
I usually play all Freedom Free stuff.
Fair enough. Can't object. Finally, once again, registration for SwagCon, a.k.a. Congress, so very wrong about games, fun times, good vibes only, trans rights are human rights, board game jamboree in Kingston, Ontario, July 25th, 26th, 27th. There are still some small amount of tickets available. As of last check, there were 9. We would love to see you. If not, that's cool too. URL to purchase a ticket in the episode notes. Look forward to it.
Eventbrite.
That's it. That's the news. And why it doesn't matter, we're now going to move on to our feature game, which is Seven Empires by Matt Gertz. Full disclosure, in the past, not for some time, I've helped Matt Gertz with some translation and rulebook layouts. I've had nothing to do with Seven Empires, though. Matt Gertz is definitely one of Swag's favorite designers. He is certainly one of my favorite designers. He's designed 2 of my top 10 all-time favorite games. In 2005, he released Antica, which was his first published design. It was redeveloped in 2014 as Antica 2, which is genius. In 2006, he released Imperial, which was revamped into Imperial 2030, into 2009, which is a Swag favorite. 2010, he did Navigador. 2013, he did his design for which he's probably best known, which is Concordia. I, however, harbor a very soft spot for Navigador, which is underappreciated. I even enjoy some of his other weirder designs like Hamburgum and the Princes of Machu Picchu. I don't have much experience with transatlantic and rolling freight, but alas, it is what it is. So, Seven Empires was released in 2024 in Europe by longtime collaborators at PD Verlag, and it finally hit Canadian shores a few weeks ago. It is in many ways a redevelopment of Imperial, but it is far more different from Imperial than 2030 is. So it's a significant change to the system. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Seven Empires? By the way, some recent appropriate love on the Guild for the unhelpful summary. So kudos to you, Walker. Why don't you give us one of those patented unhelpful summaries?
What you're doing in Seven Empires, Mark, is you're taking control of an empire. and you're developing it into something great, and it's dominating the countryside, and it's about to win, and then some person takes a card, and suddenly you don't have control of that empire anymore, and they run it into the ground, and it's a shadow of its former self, and you look over at what used to be a great nation, and you realize that you invested poorly.
Elections have consequences, Walker.
It's true.
So do card drafting. So, in Imperial, there were six nations, and it was a stock game. You had money, there was cash flow, you would buy stocks, and whoever had the most stocks at a given nation took turns for that nation. There was no player order, there was just a nation order, and whoever controlled it did it, and that was how Imperial worked. Seven Empires has a slightly more traditional, at the same time less traditional, turn structure. Empires don't take turns anymore. Players take turns. And when it is your turn, you activate one of the empires that is not yet activated this round for which you have control. So, say I control the Russians and the Prussians. It's my turn. The Russians have already gone this round, this decade, which is how rounds are activated. I take a turn with the Prussians. If my turn comes around again, and neither the Russians nor the Prussians are eligible to activate, I might be in a position where I'm like, oh, okay, Walker, activate the Austro-Hungarians. Like, okay. So it's this weird situation where it has some of the same dynamics as Imperial, where sometimes people effectively skip turns, but it is internalized in a different way. And indeed, that kind of comparison set has some of the same tension of Imperial, but implemented and internalized in a different way is going to be a through line through a lot of what Seven Empires does.
Yeah, it's like very streamlined. In the other games, you had like two different piles of money, or at least one of them you did. You had your money, and then you had the country's money.
Yep.
And so you had to keep those separate. It was always, you know, well, where does that money come from?
Yes.
I don't know. So this is, everything's been streamlined. Every empire is going to get exactly eight turns. So you need to figure out how best to use those eight turns and timing. The game is all about timing, because instead of using a rondelle system, it's using this conveyor system where you have two actions available at the start with the three. There's five actions total.
Two actions that are locked at the start, three actions available.
So you have five different actions you can take. So if you've taken an action, you now have to wait for that to drop off the end of the conveyor belt so it goes into the pool of available actions. And so when to score, or when to, you know, make yourself more powerful in order to score and then get that scoring before that power is taken away is very essential. When am I going to be the first player? When should I, you know, expand out with a particular empire so you can, you know, capitalize on the growth that you've made?
Absolutely, because hard-won territorial gains can evaporate very quickly. And the difference between doing the empire action, which gives you 1 point of power for that empire based on every flag that it has on the board, at the peak of your power with, say, 8, 9, or 10, can be very, very different from when you've got 4, 5, or 6. It may not seem like a huge difference, but since the scoring of Seven Empires is all about the relative ranking of each of the empires at the end of the game, those 2 points could be the difference between 3rd and 5th place, depending, and that could be a huge swing. So, let me make a confession, Walker. Over the plays of Seven Empires, when I first read about how Seven Empires worked and I looked at the action selection mechanism, the way this conveyor belt worked, I immediately thought, this seems very restrictive. And it's probably going to lead, I thought, to very scripted, very staid, very predictable gameplay where every nation was working on more or less the same clock. That is not how things shake out in Seven Empires at all. The first turn is often very similar, like the first round can go very quickly because a common, not the only thing that they can do, but a very common thing to do is just to build and deploy, which causes every city to spew out a military unit.
People always want more stuff.
People always want more stuff, and it makes sense. It builds up the infrastructure. You know, it's a very reasonable first turn move, and indeed the other first turn moves seem a bit risky or a bit strange in comparison. And that's not to say they're not viable. But anyway, suffice to say, on a conceptual level, I have no idea how the action selection mechanism in Seven Empires produces the varied board states that it does. Because over the course of the game, Russia may be ascendant, or France may be dominating the entire continent, or the Ottomans may show up in the Irish Sea. I mean, who knows? There's a lot of weird and ahistorical stuff that can happen. By the way, if you want something that's vaguely historically simulationist, look elsewhere, I assure you. But I don't know how this happens. Like, here I am, I'm playing the game, and in the first round, everyone takes builder to play. Okay, fine. Not all the time, but sometimes. And then by the next round, by midway through the next round, the map is completely different how it was two games ago, and I don't know how we got there. It's so weird. Do you have that sense of dislocation, or is it just me?
No, I agree. I think the most interesting part is looking around the table and see who has invested interest in what.
Yeah.
And it's, I can push, you know, Britain out into this area because I know Mark has British
stock
as well.
Whatever you want to call
and
it.
And I don't have any Prussia stock. So even though Mark has Prussia stock, he has more British stock. So I can just sort of take a few territories from Prussia.
Yep.
He won't be too upset and he's not going to retaliate because he still wants Britain to be powerful. And I don't have any Turkish stock at all, so I'm just going to lay waste to that whole area and not care about it and hope that it can hold until I can utilize that and score it.
So one area in which I think Seven Empires is manifestly more flexible than Imperial is, because sometimes when you streamline, what you do is you take away things and flexibility goes away. Sometimes it's par for the course. But one area where it's more flexible is precisely in those instances where a given player has strong stakes in more than one power, which happens almost always in a game of Seven Empires. In Imperial, if you had strong influence in a couple of neighbors, frequently you would end up in a position where you look at the map and you'd be like, I can't advance one without completely kneecapping the other. It's not possible. That just means you made a mistake. You did a bad job of investing. You should have made different investment choices, which is fine, but unsatisfying in the moment. In Seven Empires, yes, it's almost inevitable that you have this case where it's like, yes, my Prussian influence is butting up against my English influence, but I care more about the English, and I can find a way to make sure that the English grow powerful, not too much at the expense of the Prussians. But oh wait, all this time I'm being manipulated by Walker's stake in Spain doing this. Crap. So the sort of intersection of multiple different country combinations is much more dynamic and fluid in Seven Empires, and it doesn't lead you to get yourself in a hole. On that topic, just to continue that topic of being in a hole, the financial system is completely gone. Instead of buying stock in a country and having treasuries, you just take cards off a stack. It's like, oh, at various times in the game, usually at the end of every round, everyone gets a card. It's like, okay, I'll take the best card from Spain that's left, I'll take the best card that's England, whatever. And consequently, there's no real death spiral that countries ever get into, because it can get to the case that in Imperial and Imperial 2030, a country's doing poorly, it spends a whole bunch of money, either wisely or unwisely, and then it's not doing well on the board, so nobody wants to buy stock, so no money goes into the treasury, so it stays poor. And so it just spirals into irrelevance, because no one's willing to buy the stock, and it can't pay out more, and it's a whole thing. In Seven Empires, you never have that worry because the empires are always able to churn out a little bit more for you, and you're not paying anything for them. You're getting them effectively for free, so the only opportunity cost is not taking something else. And so consequently, they're all consequential right up until the very end of the game.
Speaking of the game, they do yet another fantastic job of that, because there are two main ways to advance an empire. Either you're taking a palace action, which is going to, you know, move you up the track due to the infrastructure you've bought, like how powerful your palace is, how you've upgraded the cities, or you're going to take a flag action, which is going to score you, move you up the track based on how you've expanded your empire. And what happens at the end of the game is both of these score again. So even though, you know, you don't have the right actions you want to do again, you can see that you're going to be able to activate that empire last, and no one's going to be able to take your territory from you, so you can just blast out at the very end and do your automatic empire scoring. Just the way that works out, I think, is perfect.
Which is also dovetails with another element that Seven Empires... I'm setting this up, by the way, in the context of Shut Up and Sit Down, this would be the mid-review twist, but whatever. I have a number of ways in which I think Seven Empires suffers in comparison with Imperial and Imperial 2030. But one thing that can happen in Imperial 2030 is that the last few turns, certainly of many empires, can be relatively predictable. There's a cycle near the end of the game that becomes sometimes relatively obvious for a number of powers, where they just cycle through the same two spots of the rondel over and over and over and over again, partially because they're rushing the end game. and partially because it's they've got a dominant position and they can exploit it. Now, the good news about that is that that usually means you're close to the end, and that typically those turns, there may be a large number of those turns, but that's usually like the last 10, 15 minutes of the game. Seven Empires, though, by virtue of the way that endgame works, you can look at it and say, look, there are only two of the five actions that actually give me more points directly. And in Imperial, it was inconceivable that you would skip those. In Seven Empires, you might, because it is conceivable that partially because of the weird emerging alliances that we talked about before, it's like, yeah, I could advance Spain's position a couple points, but really, what if I advanced Spain's position a little bit less, but took a chunk out of the French in the process? Okay, that makes more sense to me. And so I'll do it that way, knowing that that guaranteed scoring is right around the corner.
But to counteract that, the amount of time this game takes, like, sure, you know, those back and forth in Imperial 2050...
2030,
you're taking turns, you know, it only takes 15 minutes, but that's 15 minutes of a three-hour game. This is...
It can be 3 hours. I'll take your point that it's much longer.
True. Seven Empires takes about an hour and a half. It is a ton of game in this little amount of time for what it does.
I agree with you that the time savings are considerable because there can be, you know, I talk about how maybe like the first round is semi-scripted, or maybe the first couple rounds are a little bit semi-scripted in Seven Empires. But those quick semi-scripted rounds take like 5 minutes instead of the, you know, 10 to 15 minute of scripted activity near the end of Imperial. And Imperial also has those dynamics where it's like, well, obviously I do this next and obviously I do that next. And yes, it is much longer. And for all my complaints about how sometimes the Seven Empires can be a little bit constrained and forced play, the proportion of forced play is smaller and it is shorter. And so for all the genius of Imperial, there are a lot of turns where it's like, well, can we get to the next thing? With experienced players, though, those semi-forced turns get much, 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 much faster. But that's an excuse you can make for almost any game that's a little bit longer than you'd like it to be. So with that context in mind.
Another thing I like about these games is the look on people's faces if they haven't played anything like this before. Because a lot of people are used to like an Axis and Allies or a Risk or those type of games where you control one empire for the whole game. It's yours. You're advancing it and you want it to do well. In these games, it's whoever has the most invested interest. So you might be working with, you know, Britain for the entire game, and the last four turns, someone's taken a card, and there's no way you can get it back, and now they're controlling Britain, and they're doing something completely different, whereas Britain was just holding off France's back door from, you know, all of the invasions. Now suddenly, not only is that back door wide open, but they're also actively attacking France as well. It can, like, turn on a dime, and I love that kind of dynamic.
It is also the case that there is a fascinating asymmetry in the different empires in Seven Empires. The Prussians are effectively the weakest, and the British are effectively the strongest. Their board position in terms of starting cities, which is to say military production capacity, as well as how vulnerable they are to having their infrastructure be sat on by enemies and thus be rendered hors de combat, are vastly different. This is reflected in the card values. When you get more influence in a country, you just take a card of that country. The British cards top out at 4. The Prussian cards top out at 7, which means that at the end of the game, if Prussia does really well, that 7 card is worth almost twice as many points as that British card would have been worth. But that's a big if. It's a bit of a lift to get those other... Like, France and England ain't no thing making France and England powerful in a game of Seven Empires. It's pretty obvious to do. There's not a whole lot you can do about it, frankly. France is a little more vulnerable. But, like, what? You're going to invade England? A number of people have tried. It tends not to work well. And so this is internalized relatively well. The other Imperial games, every nation is effectively equal to each other. They have the same number of building spots, and that's fine. But I do like how you end up with these different margin calls based on different cards that are available.
The cards are different, and the pieces, the mix of troops and boats you have is also different. And I'm also wondering if they had those starting locked actions, if they just mixed those up and made them sort of Empire...
Maybe.
You know, based might have been interesting. It might have, like, skewed the game a little too hard. But, yeah. I mean, it would be interesting.
Yeah, possibly. It's an interesting question. It's an interesting design question whether you could mess with that without sending things to spiral.
I can see where it'd be bad.
The other thing that I'll say where Seven Empires is slightly preferable is that combat is just a touch more interesting. And it's actually more complicated than it works in Imperial and Imperial 2030. In that, there are now different units with different capabilities. Not a whole lot, very, very minor element. But most importantly, they now get to move two spaces, not one. And this can be huge, again, because you don't end up cornered in an unusual situation too more. And because the game is constrained, there's the opportunity for bigger turns. Imperial is an awful lot about the slow metastasis of Empire's borders with very minor shifts here and there. Whereas Seven Empires, you can have much more consequential turns, which emphasizes the importance of timing. And I thought the combat improvements are largely for the good. It worked out really, really neatly. People don't tend to get too confused about how the different units work, and it's all for the good. Now, here's my biggest problem, though, with Seven Empires. And that is that the sense of dynamism, I think, is on its head. Because, as I say, in Imperial, there's this slow, elaborate movement of borders. But the economy ramps up in Imperial. As people get more cash, they're able to buy more expensive bonds than the ones they started with. This can lead to dramatic reversals because money is hidden most of the time. You can play with open money, but it's a matter of preference. Even with open money, though, the timing of investment is a little uncertain. It's not random, but it's variable depending on people's decisions. And so there can be massive turns of fortune if you don't protect yourself well enough, if you make a country too strong when you shouldn't have, if you leave a country too weak when you shouldn't have. And there are these dramatic moments of reversal, and the economy ramps up in intensity. Seven Empires works the other way around. You start off with the best cards probably you're ever going to get, because you start with the best value cards in each empire, and yeah, there might be a couple that are available based on player counts that are pretty great, but the values of the cards start going down. And as a consequence, it is more about doubling down on what you've already got or making safer bets. And those moments of control change are vastly fewer in Seven Empires. That's a matter of preference, but I really feel that Imperial leverages this distinction between you, the player, and the empires you're associated with far, far better than Seven Empires does. It still has that same idea, but it's less dynamic. You're changing control less often. It's not infrequently the case that you're looking at the round and say, what would I have to do in order to gain control of anything? And the answer is often, I would need to draft two cards over the course of two rounds and nobody else take anything.
I agree with that, but I think for its time, it did what it was supposed to do. I think in this age of people playing all sorts of different games, because if you have no idea that that's going to happen, these drastic changes in the economy.
Oh yeah, it's definitely more back and forth. Totally.
Exactly. So teaching Seven Empires and playing Seven Empires and seeing how it's going to work, you can grasp that much quicker and the playtime is much quicker. I think it is a game for its time, for sure.
I don't know about for its time.
Well, I mean, comparatively. Like, I think, like, 20...
Oh, you don't mean a game for the current era.
No.
You mean a game for its duration. Sorry, I misinterpreted.
Well, I mean, and for, you know, for the way people are playing games now. I think it's designed more for the way people are playing games now.
I don't know, man. People are playing heavier and heavier Euros. We just talked about Galactic Cruise. We just talked about Shackleton Base.
It's true.
The Talisurta moves lots of units. Mind Clash is getting heavier and heavier.
I suppose. I just, that's the way I feel.
Sure. And I respect your feelings, and I acknowledge those feelings.
Why, thank you, Mark.
Obviously, it's a matter of personal preference, right? And let's just stipulate that Imperial is significantly longer.
Yes.
Than, in almost all instances, than Seven Empires. But I would rather play a game that is slightly longer and much more dynamic and much more fluid and has a more interesting economic system than the way that Seven Empires has done it, because fundamentally, the way that you interact with empire control, I feel too much has been stripped away. I think that effectively, yeah, you get a little bit of control change. Yeah, you get a little bit of those margin calls about what to invest in. And I will grant you also that there's always a greater uncertainty as to the payoff. Again, near the end of Imperial, I think the end game of Imperial is not when it's at its best. You have those circumstances where you get to look to see what a stock is worth. You know that buying a stock will get you money and therefore get you a certain amount of points, though the uncertainty is relatively minor. Seven Empires, there's less opportunity for calculating because you don't know how the relative... The scoring is not based on absolute terms. It's based on relative terms. France may be super powerful, but if Prussia's got more points of power, well then, suck it. And so your Prussia cards are going to be worth more in comparison. But that additional level of texture to the economy, that level of dynamism of control, that sense of economic vulnerability which can be exploited by different players, I think more than justifies the additional playtime in a game of Imperial. And I think that sense of flexibility is carried through in the brilliant Rondel system, which I think is fundamentally more satisfying than the conveyor belt. The conveyor belt is fine. It gets the job done. But I think that Imperial is a significantly more open game. That having been said, again, context is super important. Imperial is my fourth favorite game of all time. And I've said that I don't like Seven Empires as much. Seven Empires is great.
I think Seven Empires is a lot easier to get to the table.
Yes,
I think it will be better for, like, people that know how to play Imperial will dominate in Imperial against people who've never played before for reasons that you've said, for manipulating the economy.
I think the same is true of Seven Empires. It's also a no-luck, pretty deterministic game.
But I think people can pick up on it a lot quicker than they can Imperial.
Not necessarily to be competitive, though. It's easier to teach, obviously. It's more approachable in terms of rule set, but I don't think that it's going to be as competitive. Like, I think experienced players are still going to dominate Seven Empires in a similar way than if they dominate Imperial. I will grant one last more concession, though, in terms of how approachable Seven Empires is. There is a dynamic that I find super interesting, and experienced players of Imperial also find super interesting and recognizes a very, very powerful position, and that is not controlling any country. In Imperial, that's very, very advantageous in a lot of ways for a variety of subtle reasons. But for new players, it feels like you're not playing the game anymore. That's not true, but that's how it feels. Seven Empires, because of the way it works, you are vastly less likely to end up in a circumstance where you are not in control of an empire. And even then, you're effectively kind of still in control of an empire because you're also allowed to activate empires that are not yours under certain conditions. So that is another way in which it is much more approachable for new players.
Overall, I enjoyed Seven Empires and would play it anytime it's suggested.
So would I. And it also, in fairness, if somebody's like, let's play Seven Empires, sometimes I would say, based on the group, based on the player count, and based on the timing, I would say, would you be interested in giving Imperial a try? I think it is superior. But there are lots of instances where I would just say, yeah, Seven Empires is the right choice, and I would not turn down a game of Seven Empires. Very often, if there's an inferior version of a game, I think, if there are two games that are very, very similar, but one is preferable, their similarity causes me not to want to play the less preferred version, even if I like them both very much. This is not true of Seven Empires. It is different enough, and I like it enough that I will happily play it anytime.
It might be a great introduction. Like, say if you don't want to put someone right into Imperial right off the bat.
Maybe.
You can play Seven Empires first, and they get a feel for that whole system, and then you can bring it up to one of the Imperial games.
Feel for some of the elements of the dynamic, I'd say, rather than the system. Because the systems are almost unrecognizable anymore. But the dynamic of there being basically the investor class and then the countries that they're manipulating with a sense of a light troops on a map feel, that is comparable, yeah?
Yeah.
Seven Empires, check it out. Really worth playing. Highly recommend it. Great game. Also check out Imperial and Antica. Wonderful, wonderful designer. And that's going to do it for this episode of So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you for joining us. We hope you had a good time. We hope you laughed. We hope you learned. We hope you discovered something about yourself and the truth of the universe.
Maybe a single tier would be good too. You know, to keep it all based.
Take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby. Thank you, Rules Explainer. Thank you so much.
Peace.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same-day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.